I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, and welcome. Or should I say welcome back to the Indie Football Podcast. I'm Ed Mallion, sports editor of The Independent, and alongside me, a return from Nizhny Novgorod, where he last night watched the game, as I'm sure you heard on yesterday's podcast, between Argentina and Croatia, is Miguel Delaney. Before I get chatting to Miguel, we've got a lot to talk about. I'm sure he'll want to spill over some more into Argentina. He's nodding at me intently. We've got Brazil-Costa Rica to deal with. Brazil, it looked like they were going to be held out by the Costa Ricans. Another frustrating performance for them against a team that was more preoccupied, I guess, with defending than anything else. And then at the last, Coutinho popping up with the goal. And then a second from Neymar in stoppage time, giving a nice veneer to that scoreline. We had Nigeria versus Iceland in Volgograd, a surprise result there. And something that really blows open Group D, giving Argentina just that little hope, but it's always the hope that kills you. And then Serbia-Switzerland, the late game from Kaliningrad, which was arguably one of the games of the tournament so far. These are two teams that I may have got stuck into the other day on the podcast, and they bit back today. It was a brilliant game there, where Serbia took the lead, and Switzerland became the first team to complete a comeback, I think, in the 26th game of the World Cup so far. So without further ado, I'll send it up to St. Petersburg, where Jack Pitbrook and Jonathan Liu will talk to Brazil-Costa Rica before me and Miguel take over.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, Ed. It's Jack. I'm here in our flat in St. Petersburg, where I've just got back from Brazil 2, Costa Rica 0. That might sound like quite a straightforward win, but it really wasn't. Brazil, I mean, I'm sure you know the score. Brazil didn't score until the 91st minute. And before then, they'd found it pretty hard going to get past Costa Rica, who were just as disciplined, organised, hardworking and dirty as they were in the World Cup 4 years ago. And there were amazing scenes of of relief, emotion, the release of tension when Brazil won at the end, so much so that Neymar collapsed to the ground on the final whistle, shaking with tears, head in his hands, on his knees, and had to be dragged to his feet by Gabriel Jesus and Fernandinho and Miranda soon after. So, I mean, like any Brazil game, it was a big emotional experience, but they did manage to get there in the end. Johnny is currently cooking, but nevertheless, let's see what he thought about the game. Johnny, what did you think about the Brazil game?
I thought Brazil did really well to hold it together. I think, you know, as we saw with Argentina the previous night, admittedly a much inferior team, it's very easy to kind of lose your heads when the prospect of disaster and you know, 2 points from two games would have been not far away from that, rears its head. And so I thought they stuck to their task pretty well. And Costa Rica really just seemed to kind of fade as the game went on, and Brazil started creating more and more chances, started turning the screw, and even though, you know, they left it quite late, I thought they were well worth the win.
Yeah, I think it's been a World Cup where we've realised that, like, the bar is slightly The bar is basically lower than we thought in terms of... Oh, no, sorry, the bar is higher than we thought in terms of, like, the performances we can expect from big teams against lesser ones. Like, no big team has recorded a big thumping win against the lesser side. You know, England, France...
Without chemical enhancement.
Yeah, indeed. Brazil, France, England, obviously have all found it difficult. Argentina are yet to win. Germany, as we speak, are yet to win. So I think we have to accept that these big teams are going to, you know, they're not going to turn over teams in quite the way that we might expect. But I guess the big question, given how open the World Cup now is whether Brazil have enough to beat another good team. Like, could they, you know, could they beat France or Spain or even Portugal or Mexico over in a tense match when things start to go against them, given what we now know about what we found out about their fragility 4 years ago? I think it's very difficult to get away from the 7-1 and the sense with Brazil that, given how emotional they get when they win, that if one thing could turn against them, then it would all start to go wrong. And you know, a big part of that is Neymar, who is very much the kind of, who sort of represents the emotional, slightly fragile nature of the team, and yet also represents all their best sides as well. He's coming for a lot of stick as usual, but Johnny, what did you think about Neymar today?
Not their best player by a long stretch. I thought he squandered quite a few chances that really would have opened the game up for Brazil a lot earlier. Even in the first half, there were a couple of one-on-ones where he basically had a little bit of a heavy touch, and I thought Coutinho was brilliant, but ultimately it was, you know, at the end, kind of not the 97th minute, Neymar sort of got his goal, he got his moment. So while all the focus was on him, I didn't think it was his greatest game, actually.
Yeah, I sort of half agree with that. Like, I think that I do agree that Neymar's touch was bad. Like, he did look like someone who's only played one game after 3.5 months out. Like, there were two or three times in the first half where he would overrun the ball or give it away and actually the chance that Costa Rica had to go 1-0 up in the first half, which I think Borges missed, came from Neymar giving the ball away in midfield, conceding a free kick, and then Costa Rica attacked. That said, I think he improved a lot in the second half. I think he stopped coming to chase for the ball at the halfway line. He started to play high and wide on the left, trying to stretch play, you know, knowing that he might not get the ball, but that it would be better for the team. And he took a massive kicking, like he always does.
That's definitely worth noting. He got a real... he basically got some proper treatment from Costa Rica. And I think it was definitely a more mature performance than we saw against Switzerland, where I think at times he was like a little... He treated it almost like a futsal game or something. This was definitely a more mature performance from him. I think we're still waiting to see the real Neymar.
Yeah, I agree with that, although as much as I did like parts of Neymar's performance today, there were bits in the second half where he reminded me a bit of a 10-year-old who had organised a game of football for his birthday and who needed to score a goal because it's his birthday.
There was that bit right near the end, which, you know, neither of us actually saw the first time because, you know, we were busy writing. But this was right in the 97th minute where he basically did a little bunny hop over his head.
Yeah, he did a scorpion kick over, I think it was Yeltsin Tejada. So this was on 94 minutes. Brazil were meant to be, like, closing out the game, trying to see out the win. They're only 1-0 up. There's about 3 added minutes left to play. And Neymar, instead of holding the ball in the corner, does a rainbow kick over a defender's head. Now, it worked, so nothing bad came of it. But imagine if he'd lost the ball and Costa Rica had gone down the other end and scored. And I actually think that one of the reasons why Neymar was so emotional at the end is that he wanted this to be about him. And he thought it was going to be about him. One, when he went through on goal on 72 minutes and then hit wide, disappointingly. And then, when he was awarded a penalty, and he thought he was going to get to win the game, and then the penalty was rescinded by VAR. And all of a sudden, that moment was taken out of his hands. And when Coutinho scored the crucial goal, like the goal that put Brazil 1-0 up on 91 minutes, the move went Marcelo's cross, Firmino's header, Gabriel Jesus flick, and Coutinho finish. And Neymar was just kind of stood at the end of the box, at the edge of the box, doing nothing. And I mean, it's easy to read too much into these things, but you do wonder whether Neymar was thinking, well, this was, you know, I want this to be about me. I want to win the game. And maybe that's why he produced that rainbow flick. And maybe that's why, having scored the tap-in from Douglas Costa's cross with the last kick of the game, he collapsed in tears because he finally got what he wanted, the goal, but equally he knew deep down that it wasn't his win in quite the way he wanted. But I guess ultimately that speaks to the bigger issue, which is that Brazil are improving. They were better than they were against Switzerland, but they're not there yet. They haven't produced a complete performance yet, and neither has Neymar. But there is still an awful lot left to come from this team. They will now, it's very difficult now to see them not getting through to the last 16, and I think we're all looking forward to seeing a bit more from them then. But
I think they'll struggle against, they might struggle against teams that stretch them, that counter them effectively down the wings and exploit that space that, well, today Fagner and Marcelo tend to leave behind them when they go and attack. I think you're going back to the start of the game, but for the first 20 minutes, it's easy to forget that Costa Rica were actually the better side. They were really well organised and they had the best chance of the game. And if a slightly better side, a slightly more cogent attacking side that's prepared to put a bit of enterprise into it, starts to attack them, we'll kind of see what this Brazil defence is made of.
That's something that we're all looking forward to. But tomorrow, Johnny and I fly from St. Petersburg to Moscow to Nizhny Novgorod for the England game on Sunday. So we'll be updating you again with our thoughts on the podcast on Saturday evening. Bye.
We will talk to them tomorrow. I didn't realise it is already that soon. England play Panama on Sunday in... where's that? Is that Kaliningrad or is that Nizhny?
That's Nizhny.
Where you just came back from.
I just came back from Nizhny.
So what did you... let's get your thoughts on Brazil... don't drop anything. Just get your thoughts on Brazil-Costa Rica first. You weren't impressed with Brazil against Switzerland. Today, I think they were slightly better, full stop. They were also just... they got the result today, which I guess is the difference between... They were better than Switzerland, but today they were better than Costa Rica. Looked like they were going to get frustrated for ages and ages and ages and ages and ages. And then two goals in stoppage time makes all the difference. So where are you standing on them now?
I suppose they showed perseverance. And I think this was the interesting... In fact, Frank de Boer kind of pointed it out in his column for us the other day. That this is... He said he expected all the big teams to step up because quality will tell. And the kind of pressure of needing to do things. And I think Brazil did show impressive perseverance. I think that they still seem very overrated from how they were talked up before the tournament, but there is that backbone there, and they're off to a good start. They're up and running now after the win, and they still look a bit. I mean, as if they can be physically bullied like against Switzerland, and as well as that, they're still so whiny. Even though there's only four members of that squad who were in the 2014 team, and Chicho was meant to kind of get rid of that mentality after the 7-1 all that. It's still what we saw throughout most of 2014 is still there. This whining and this refusal to take responsibility and this complaint. I mean, this is supposed to be a physically strong team and it's complaining about everything.
They are quite a whiny bunch. I think they are a good team. I said before the tournament, I think they're really good. What Chicho brings as the coach is... they're going to be like his Corinthians team, which weren't a team that scored loads and loads of goals. They didn't smash teams 6-0 necessarily. They were a team that, against the better sides, against they beat Chelsea in the Club World Cup final. And I think that this Brazil is better equipped to play against the top European sides than any Brazil side of the last probably 6 to 10 years, almost. They are going to, when they come up against the elite sides, they're going to be ready. I think that's what they've been preparing for. I almost think they felt they didn't need to prepare for teams like Costa Rica because I think they just thought that their natural game would win out, and it wasn't far off not winning out when it came to Coutinho, 91, and then Neymar's goal at 93, 94 minutes. What do you think of the, Johnny and Jack just then talked about Neymar feeling he needed to be the centre of attention? The breaking down in tears at the end of the game. Do you feel that was genuine or do you think that was performative?
Performative, completely. I think, ultimately, Neymar is a player that makes Cristiano Ronaldo look humble at this point. I think he must be the most narcissistic in world football. And it feels like PSG, it's not good for his game, and I'm not sure it's good for the Neymar persona either, because it feels like he has to play up to these theatrics. I mean, a 2-0 win over Costa Rica, come on. Like, it's...
Well, we had a really, really good Neymar chat. When was that? Must have been like a month ago. Was that post-Champions League final, but pre-World Cup?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
We did a big section on Neymar.
His gold coat.
Yeah, well, the parties.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Unai Emery left at 10 p.m. and then Neymar partied for three more days.
Something for
Arsenal
to look forward to.
I felt bad for Costa Rica because they did defend so well, particularly for Keylor Navas, who I wrote about today. I think is just such an underappreciated goalkeeper. He's kind of in the shade given mold, I guess, but like much, much better.
Yeah.
Obviously, and what I wrote in the piece is 2015, he was part of that De Gea deal that fell through memorably on deadline day. And they were trying to get him out then, and they've been trying to get him out ever since. And he's won three Champions Leagues back to back. You know, if the keeper was the weak link of the team, that doesn't happen. At no point do you ever watch Real Madrid and think Keylor Navas is the weak link. Like, it just doesn't occur to you because he's been so solid ever since. You know, they've been trying to sign De Gea. Eventually, De Gea becomes out of reach. Florentino decides he wants to get Kepa instead. Has a deal lined up for Kepa in January. And Zidane, who's only been there for 2.5 years, or in fact, it was 2 years in January, he's won two Champions Leagues already and has enough power to be able to say, no, I want to stick with Navas. But only because Zidane has won two Champions Leagues does he have the power to say that, basically. And then this summer, it looks very likely they're going to go for Alisson or Thibaut Courtois. So what, like, you know, it's frustrating that they decide that they don't want him, but eventually one club is going to pick up Keylor Navas for no money, and they're going to get a very, very good goalkeeper.
A bit like the 2009 situation with Real Madrid, where, you know, suddenly players like Robben and Schneider were up for grabs. And actually, it's why Costa Rica as well, they could have a big say in this group yet. I mean, that's going to be a very interesting final side game. Serbia having to beat Brazil, Costa Rica, they could frustrate Switzerland. This still.
I think the Serbians, I've seen, feel they blew it today.
They probably did, yeah. I mean, to be honest,
they're 1-0 up and then they've thrown that away.
Also, they transformed second half as well, where they went from looking very exciting and kind of mobile to then playing route one.
So now we think Switzerland are favourites to go through.
It does look like we could have a real majority European last 16 at the moment.
Okay, let's look at let me bring up the tables, because I haven't really thought about that, but that is, well, I guess it's a symptom of so in Group A, Russia and Uruguay are through, that's confirmed. It's only what order they go through in. Group B, Spain and Portugal are most likely, though Iran could spring a shock. Group C, France and Denmark, though Australia could spring a shock. Group D, Croatia top the group. I get. Well, should we talk about the other game that happened in Group D today, the leftover game? So after last night's stunning events in Nizhny Novgorod, at which, of course, you were present, Argentina needed Nigeria to go and beat Iceland today. And they went and did it. Ahmed Musa with two goals. One of them, a sensational sort of... Is that your phone or mine?
It's mine. Sorry.
That's right.
Thanks to my friend of the podcast, Martin Gritton.
Oh, well, I mean, Scotland will never qualify for a World Cup, so...
Cornwall.
Grits... No, I don't want to talk about Grits. Nigeria beat Iceland. Ahmed Musa with two goals. The first one, a wonderful volley that you missed, but you just watched the highlights of them and were quite impressed by. And the second one, I don't know why I think this, but I think it's a classic World Cup goal in the way that... It's the way he just... absolutely outgasses a European defender and dribbles it past the goalkeeper. But then I was watching it live and I thought, he's going to smash this into one of the defenders. And he just took that extra kind of half second, tiny bit of composure that was needed, buries it. Nigeria win. Iceland now on 1 point. Nigeria on 3 points. So on the final day, Argentina play Nigeria. Both sides know that a win could take them through. Iceland are going to play a rotated Croatia side, and they know a win will take them through. But Croatia realistically need a point just to secure the top of the group. So, what do you think?
Argentina were so bad that I really don't expect anything from them. And I've gone from kind of...
They've bottomed out. Yeah. They can't get worse than that, can they?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I've gone from kind of like before the Croatia game, kind of willing them, because for many reasons, because of Argentina, because of Messi, willing them to kind of get through and just do it. And after the game, kind of thinking, if they go away, this tournament loses nothing, which is a remarkable thing to say about Messi. But he does... I mean, from everything we've heard from the camp, he does look... It looks like this whole project is spent, and as if he's kind of he's mentally run its course, this whole thing, because after so much disappointment, so much dependency on it, as if he, like, he drags him here, then he gets here and he sees this shambles, as if he's kind of withdrawn into himself. But maybe, I suppose, if they thought they were gone, that's when you get this jolt where, hang on, we're still in this. You never know what that can do. It could kind of, you know, reawaken them all. But I didn't see the Iceland-Nigeria game because I actually quite a moment at the World Cup's all about. I had a flight at 6:40 p.m. Russian time, which is just as half time was about to come, and we touched down at about 7:25 in Moscow, just when there was 10 minutes left. I was with loads of Argentine fans because they were going from Nizhny through Moscow to St. Petersburg, because it's very hard to get direct flights anywhere that doesn't go through Moscow in this country. But the Argentina fans, obviously, as we were coming 10 minutes from landing, they obviously started to get coverage on their phones and check the score, and burst into song. And you know, Nigeria, we love you. You have to win. I know, every day we love you more. Well, they may not on Tuesday, but you can actually see that on my Twitter where I posted a video.
Some flawless self promotion from you there. Do we think Argentina have it in them? Because the look of Messi, for me, is someone that has almost lost interest in... He looks like he's completely and utterly removed from the Argentina like project. You know, this is a guy who, lest we forget, retired from international football, had to be convinced to come back out of international retirement. You know, he suffered that heartbreak of losing the three finals in three summers. So now you've got a guy who just hasn't looked himself since he's been here, and someone who knows Messi well and is around the Argentina camp said that the Leo I know has not come to Russia, which is kind of, you know, shocking, but also kind of not that surprising if you have been watching the football. Yeah, you know, that we haven't seen... You know, I guess it's not that uncharacteristic, actually, in terms of his recent penalty form, for him to miss that penalty against Iceland. But it's one of that was one of the quietest Messi games I've ever seen against Croatia. I've seen a lot of Messi, and I just don't remember a game where he's done that little.
That's what shocked me more than anything. I mean, obviously there's been this wider debate about Messi and his influence and Ronaldo and all this nonsense, but... I mean, I saw some bizarre tweet from some of these who work for the BBC about how Messi shrinks for Argentina and disappears, whereas Ronaldo grows three times. I mean, that's ridiculous. In fact, actually, this is quite an interesting inversion of the last World Cup, where Ronaldo scored a hat-trick or four goals or runs to get them there, then did nothing at the tournament. Messi's done the same, and then nothing at the tournament. But anyway, besides all that, basically... I mean, what was still most astonishing about the game, because Messi is the ultimate clutch player... When it got to 1-0 or 2-0, and whatever about the system, I was stunned that he didn't just kind of decide on himself to just drag them out, get himself into the centre, get involved, and just at least try to do it. The fact that he had so few touches was amazing. And it does maybe point to this, that it feels like he's just something's changed now. And he's almost just subconsciously just demotivated by this whole situation. And like, I do have a certain sympathy for him, because first of all, Argentina are arguably the biggest basket cases in world football, even more than England, I would say.
Yeah.
Neurotically kind of crushed by their own history and all that pressure, which means so many of these great players they had in 2010 to a lesser extent 2014 almost play within themselves for Argentina, and Messi kind of dragged them out of that. But then it had this inverse effect where then it created more and more of a dependence on Messi. More and more of these players bizarrely shrunk for Argentina, until we get to this bizarre point where suddenly Messi has to drag them through. I mean, the stats from qualifying are ridiculous. They out of 8 games, they won 1 without Messi. Mm-hmm. Got something like 7 points out of 8. Then with Messi, they got 21 points out of a possible 30. So he really has taken them here. And then, I mean, and then it's almost like we've reached a break where he can take them no more. It's, and as well as that, there's the consequence of, I suppose, years of dysfunction in Argentine football have like inevitably led to this.
I mean, it's something I've already got an idea for something to write when they eventually go out this tournament, whether that's on Tuesday or whether that's in the semi-finals. Because there's so much more to this. There's so much more to what's going on around the Argentina camp. You know, the reason they've cycled through coaches. There is a detachment between kind of some of the players and the national team anyway. And that's before you remember Messi's individual case, where he's had a peculiar relationship with Argentina forever. I mean, I remember the bicentennial celebration game, September 2010, against Spain at the Monumental, where he kind of lit up a game in Argentina for the first time, and it was the first time the Argentine crowd had really sung his name, and it was seen as like a watershed moment. Mm-hmm. It's like by that point he'd already won Barcelona like several Champions Leagues. He was already the best player on the planet at that point. So like they, you know, it took them a while to really appreciate who he is and what he is. And I just wonder, I do wonder sometimes, and this World Cup has really hammered it home, is if he just feels more part of Barcelona than he does as part of Argentina.
I was thinking that today, actually. I mean, well, he's lived in Barcelona since he was, what, 12?
13, yeah.
12, 13, I mean, most of his life, his formative years.
he's incredibly happy in Barcelona. He's got his family there. He's surrounded by his friends. He's got, as I say, kids and a lovely wife. And he's got everything he could ever want. And I just don't think, you know, like, even he said, like, his dream is to go back to Rosario and play for Newell's Old Boys. And I don't see a scenario where it can happen, almost. I don't know how someone of Messi's super, super, super stardom almost can go back to living in Argentina. I was there in March, and it, you know, it's not, I mean, it's a safe country, but there are still like significant issues, and I just can't really envision it happening. It would be great. I mean, even if he could barely walk, he would still be so far above the level of the Argentinian league, it would be farcical. But we've gone way off track. So that group is actually fairly well set up. Group E: Brazil, Switzerland, Serbia, Costa Rica. The thing to note about this group, actually, Miguel, is that if Brazil win the group, they're possibly going to face Germany in the round of 16. Because, as we know, Sweden and Mexico won their opening games, and then Germany and South Korea lost. We've got Mexico versus South Korea this weekend. Oh, this is Saturday. Which might well be the game that sends Mexico through. In which case, you're looking at Sweden and Germany battling for second place, and that would be to face Brazil in the next round. Now, I want to know where you stand. Do you want maybe one absolute blockbuster round of 16 clash, or do you just want all the good teams to stay in as long as possible?
I prefer all the good teams staying as long as possible. I mean, we don't want to get into a 2002 situation where suddenly, yes, all the shocks are good, and then the last few games are underwhelming. And also because the kind of mid-tier sides will inevitably run out of steam, and then they kind of be picked off, exactly what happens. Maybe one blockbuster, which we could well have if it's France-Argentina. But Germany-Brazil, even if the Germans have had problems and Brazil have had problems, I still think they're good enough that it's a bit too early for a game like that.
They're two teams that you want to see get a bit of momentum behind them and then actually hit their stride. Because Germany-Brazil sounds to me like, if you'd said at the start of the tournament that's going to be the World Cup final, that must have been among the two or three most likely combinations for the World Cup final. Jack Pitbrook did say earlier to us that he had simulated the rest of the World Cup, and he said there was a massive advantage in coming second in Group G, not first. Group G being England's group, and the reasoning is there that if Germany don't come at top of Group F, then if you come top of Group G, which England are playing to at the moment, you would face the winner of Brazil versus Germany, if that were to happen, in the Kazan quarterfinal, which is nasty. Whereas if you do come second in that group, then things become a lot easier. And so England or Belgium might have palm draw purely because of Germany's screw up. So it's something to monitor. Tomorrow's games, Migs, we're going to go to Belgium against Panama. Are we just expecting an easy enough win for the Belgians?
Yes, I think he'll batter them. Oh, no, hang on. Belgium-Tunisia.
Belgium-Tunisia.
they play Panama. I think Tunisia will be much better than they were in the first half of the first game, where it felt like they had a bit of stage fright.
It did improve.
So yeah, it did improve. I think it could be a longish night for Belgium until they get that first goal, then it could be 2-3-0.
It doesn't seem like that fun a game to me. We've also got, as I said, Mexico, South Korea. So Mexico, one of my favourite stories of the tournament so far, I've written about Rafael Marquez, who has, to say the least, a complicated legacy. He did go up into the Mount Olympus of World Cup players on Sunday afternoon when he played in his fifth World Cup, only the third player ever to play in five World Cups. But he is also wanted under the rather grand sounding, and I can't remember the exact what's the exact terminology of this. He is wanted under the Narcotic Kingpin Act. He's blacklisted by the American Department of the Treasury. No American businesses or individuals can come into contact with him for fear of sanctions. Something I realised when I saw our friend Josh from the Wall Street Journal trying to interview him in the mix zone, and I wondered if that actually contravened, because Mexico being so sensitive about this that he's drinking from separate water bottles to certain players. He is sometimes having to stay in separate hotels, like he could not, for example, stay in a Hilton. And it's a, it's a big concern. They're doing everything possible to make sure that he doesn't contravene these things. He's had all of his assets in America frozen. He did play for the New York Red Bulls for 2 years between 2010 and 2012. And he's got a soccer school, the Charitable Foundation, all of that assets frozen. While his lawyers work with the Department of the Treasury to try and get over this misunderstanding, which is that he was supposedly linked to Edson Flores, who's a big alleged drug trafficker from Mexico. So yeah, Rafael Marquez is an interesting one because he does bring a lot of, obviously, experience, and that's why Osorio brought him on 5 minutes ago, just a defensive midfielder to sit in there and kind of keep everyone calm. 39 years old. He is already playing international football. I was about to move to Monaco when the youngest player in the World Cup, Daniel Arzani, was born. So there you go, Rafael Marquez. And Sweden versus Germany, Miguel. So Germany absolutely have to win this. Sweden, with a win in their pocket, can probably sit on a draw, you'd say. So this does have potential for being a massive result if Sweden can get a draw, which, let's be honest, is not beyond them.
Yes, but I think Germany will have a big reaction to what happened last week. And you can kind of sense it from what's been said from the camp. Neuer talking about these stern words. I think they'll be primed, and I think they'll turn it on. I think actually pump Sweden's a bit harsh because they're kind of dismissing Sweden a bit, but if the Germans are properly revved, I think they can.
I was impressed with the way Germany dealt with it straight after the game. I felt they're very confident in their own ability. They're confident in their process, and I think they've made all the right noises, kind of as you suggested. I think Sweden are a fairly solid team. Like, one of their strengths is that they're just reliably well organised. They've not got a lot of pace to hit you on the counter attack. The thing that absolutely sliced and diced the Germans was Mexican speed on the on the counter with that front three exposing the space behind the fullbacks. Now, I don't expect them to ever leave that much space behind the fullbacks again. It was just ridiculous. But equally, they could do against Sweden, because their most dangerous player, I think, in terms of just pure creativity and talent, is Forsberg. But he's not a speedy winger necessarily. He's someone who drifts inside and can make things happen, and he's got a good strike in him in terms of technically hits the ball well, crossing, passing or shooting. So I would, if I was Germany, I wouldn't change too much. I mean, they can't go with the absolute gung-ho fullbacks like they did last time. Maybe a tweak of personnel. I'd consider getting Khedira out of there and playing Gundogan instead.
Yeah.
Khedira just didn't have the legs to play the box-to-box role against the Mexicans. He was just exposed every single time. And, yeah, I mean, if they are better, then it's good for the World Cup. And if they're not, then it's a great story that the Germans could be crashing out of the group stage.
Yeah, completely. But I think they will get better. I really can't see them going out early.
You've got a lot of faith in Yogi.
I'm not even a massive Yogi Löw fan. I think he's kind of surfed this ridiculous...
wave of talent.
Yeah, this conveyor belt of talent to a certain extent. But I think they'll have enough, yeah.
Do you want to do any sort of England preview now? Or do you just want to wait until tomorrow? The guy said they'll check in tomorrow from Nizhny. The big story of the day has been Gareth Southgate criticising the media that published the story the other day. It was a paparazzi picture taken from a long-lensed camera of Steve Holland's notepad, which revealed the team, and loads of people splashed it across their back pages. I mean, not us. But there's been a kind of spat, people defending their right to do that and not. I mean, for me, I just find the whole thing so boring. Like, I don't think the media should be cheerleaders.
Yeah, I mean, two things on it. First of all, I mean, does this for basically decades, the big story in tournaments for the English press? In fact, I've never really noticed it having worked in the Irish press or even the Spanish press as much. But the big thing, the big scoop, is to get the team the day before the game. I mean, a story about, I think, Italia 90 on one of the tournaments when. Two journalists were high fiving each other when they saw the team because they'd got it right, and yeah, so that's been a huge thing for decades, and yet it's something that, first of all, the public has never seemed that bothered about. Do they really care? Okay, fair enough, they're interested in kind of, oh, will he play, but in terms of someone having the team spot on the day before, the public, they're not that bothered. But secondly, here it seems like there's a proper anger because it amounts to giving away, you know, trade secrets or whatever, or, you know, it's almost just talk about like espionage level, or as if we're at war. Now that is going over the top, and I think for all of that, people have to remember that there has to be a separation between journalist and subject. And if info falls into your hands, that might be a bit of a stretch in this case, but like, obviously context matters and context changes things. But there's almost an ethical duty to print in that regard, because otherwise you're not a journalist, you're PR. I mean, and what's in the the public's interest is different to what's in the public interest, if you get me. And really, the publication of info or relevant info or facts should trump all. Really, I mean, we're not at war, and even if we were at war, I can't believe I'm going into these lengths. But I mean, nobody wants subservient. We had a subservient meeting in that regard. Then you know stuff like kind of abuse, Abu Ghraib wouldn't come out. But I'm going way off tangent there. But yeah, so ultimately, the ethics of the press. I can understand people being irritated about the story, but the ethics of the press should not be bent because people are concerned about giving away the secrets of the football team. But at the same time, this all feels overblown because most people don't really care about the starting lineup.
Yeah, it's just, you know, people on the internet like to get angry about something. As I said, there are lots of people I can tell they're spoiling for a fight about it, and people trying to get into an argument about it. And I reiterate, I don't care. I really don't think. And the best example I have of why, as I said, I really don't think it's. I just don't think it's an issue. Everyone could have guessed this team anyway. Panama know exactly what the team is going to be roughly as it is. This happened to Spain. They snapped Hierro's notepad last week. Argentina, everyone, like Belgium, they all the press reveals the teams for every country. It's not like just an England thing. But the best example I can give you is sat next to me. Why should Miguel, who's half Irish and half Spanish, have the best interest of the England football team at heart? His job is to break news and report on football. And if he got wind through a contact that Danny Welbeck was going to start...
We regularly do it with Manchester United.
Yeah, no, I know we do. But it's my point is, if you got wind that Danny Welbeck was going to start for a contact, and then we managed to confirm that via other sources, bang, right, we do the story. So, like...
If the tabloids have got a picture that does it, that reveals the team and they want to do it, then and especially the tabloids where that's very much more there in their arena, then go for it. Like if you want to do it. Like if you're worried about losing all your access and the cozy stuff with the players, then that's the decision you can make. But
also, there's been a lot of this. We're going to talk about how trust is broken in the relation to the players, but that's kind of bollocks because there has to be a stand. I mean, what happens if it comes to it where someone in the England team or someone involved does something that has to be criticised? That's why there has to be.
It's also absolute bollocks. I was talking to someone who's at the England camp today and said the players are just completely normal and fine. The players don't care. It's just, it's people who like to get angry about stuff.
Well, also, what really is more relevant to this issue is when, say, and this happens all the time, when a player is told the day before that he's dropped or whatever, he obviously tells the people around him, and then it leaks through that.
Yeah, that always happens. And as I say, I think, you as a person are a very good example of why it's absolute nonsense, this, the sort of patriotism angle, the sort of, as if it's going to damage the nation sort of thing. It means nothing to you. And ironically, the people who are covering England, who many fans have made this great betrayal, many of them are far bigger England fans than I am. they really care about England's results, whereas, I've slightly switched off in recent years. I care much more about my club than I do about the England national team. It's not, I dislike the England national team, but I'm certainly not, kind of like face paint and banging the drum sort of thing. So I think there is a slight kind of misunderstanding, but it's also, as I say, it's not something I think is interesting. Like during the World Cup and people are arguing about press ethics on a day when I'd much rather be watching a great game between Serbia and Switzerland, Brazil play Costa Rica, Neymar getting absolutely mowed down by Celso Borges, or Nigeria just running riot against Iceland.
Well, it also shows how swimmingly everything's gone for England. That if this is an issue, then there's no issue.
Yeah, there will be teacups and there will be storms. And that storm might be a hurricane. See what I did there? I think that's everything for today. Go on.
I think England will be Panama 5-0.
England will be Panama 5-0. And if you want to bet on that, then head over to Paddy Power, our sponsors. They will give you all you need to know, all the best bets and all the other things you do to make loads of money. So until that, tomorrow when we will be previewing England at length with Johnny and Jack in Nizhny Novgorod, I've been Ed Manley and this has been the Indie Football Podcast. And I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.